be after playing back.
Oh, we don't leave till about 10, so that's easy. I was just up late last night. I have absolutely no excuse for it. Pardon? Dave, you've seen these. This is really the AFN proposals. Is there anybody out in the hall, Bev? I think the local people must have put them down here. These are the AFN proposals. Yeah. Well, I think I've read them before. And we'll reconvene then, and see if others would like to have something to say this evening about these issues that we've been discussing. And I just want to say I appreciate the contributions that those who have spoken already this evening have made, and I really do find that I can learn something from what's said by each person. So I hope some more of you will feel free to contribute this evening.
Well, my name is Sandy Wasley. I am non-native with two native children. I've lived in Alaska all my life, grew up in Athabascan territory, played with Inupiat children, the first children I played with, and married a Yupik man. And of course, I've been as a non-native, been part of the native community wherever I've been, and of course I'm very concerned about 1991 and where my children fit in with the corporations. They were both born after 1971, and as such they are not stockholders. And I was asking some questions about the stock and how is it now transferred, and as I understand it can be willed, it can be inherited, and anyone can inherit it. I don't have any prepared statements, so I'm really just thinking off the top of my head, but that to me seems like if just anybody can inherit it, that could weaken the people who belong to, weaken the native membership of the corporations. When you talk about native descent, though, I think you may be talking about something different. You start talking about blood quantums, that really gets to be a ticklish issue when you have families that are married and have non-native relatives. So, you know, maybe when you're looking at who is going to be stockholders, native descent is a consideration, no matter what the blood quantum. I am concerned that because those born after 1971 are not stockholders, that as people get older and pass on, that you will have a whole group of people in the corporations who may not be native under the present system. And, you know, it's from what I've learned tonight, and I'm learning a lot, it's possible that my children's relatives will transfer some shares to them, but maybe they won't. So there, it's kind of a question, too. What do I tell them? Where do they fit in this scheme of things? Because with the land claims, we really did structure our society. And I think there's been some positive things from that. I think people have been proud to be Native, whereas before maybe they were quiet about it. But now people are proud to be Native. And maybe in some cases it's brought on an identity crisis. I don't think I see it here in this community. I see the people here quite integrated, as Carol said. Able to deal in two worlds, as Karen says. A lot of folks here have lived in two cultures, have learned to deal with it, have their identity. But out in the Bethel region, which is where my children's father is from, I see a lot of people still grappling with who they are. And I think this land claims, with its corporate law, is an issue that a lot of people aren't prepared to deal with. And Edgar said that the Native people, as a whole, probably know more about corporate law than any other group of people. And I know that they sure have to. But I'm not sure how many people do know. Maybe in this region, people are more cognizant of it, but overall, I'm not sure. And I think Ellen spoke to that too, that we need to educate people more about what it means to be a shareholder. And the corporations, as Hank and his daughter pointed out, need to show what the benefits of being a shareholder are. I don't know how you write that into the law. I don't think that we can, but maybe from all of these discussions, corporations will start doing what they should have done several years ago and start educating people about what it means to be a stockholder. So that's my how I see it from my perspective.
Thanks very much, Ms. Wesley.
Mine is real short. My name is Donna Waloya. I'm enrolled in Village and Regional, Bering Straits and Sinisac. Don't ask me why. I feel that anxious should be amended to eliminate the date when stock becomes transferable, in other words, the 1999. I feel anxious should be amended to require each ANCSA corporation to offer up to 100 shares to each native born after December 18, 1971. And that's for all the reasons that have been spoken with tonight. And if I don't feel like going over them. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
No, I'm not ready. Even if I was ready, I wouldn't. It would come off as sounding like I wasn't ready anyway. My name is Barbara Blatchford Deer. I'm enrolled to Chugach Natives. I tried to enroll in Doyon. They rejected me. So then I came home to Seward, and they were in a scurry to enroll everybody here, so I got accepted. I offered to send my picture to them to, you know, in Doyon, but they still didn't want me. I think that's a lot of the trouble, too, with the land claims. It was, nobody knew what was going on. We were promised land and money, a lot of land and money, and we all signed up, and we didn't know what we were doing. At least, you know, everywhere in McGrath area where I was living, we were just promised land and money. And down at Seward, we were also promised land and money. The changes I've seen, at first, everybody in Seward, I noticed that everybody was saying, well, she's enrolled to see Alaska. She's, you know, everybody was finding it a common grounds to, among our native people, to not get together, but differentiate different ones who are not in their corporation. And I think it's come around to now where everybody just accepts everybody as native again. Another thing I wanted to talk about, and everybody's talked about the land, so I won't say anything about the land, but it's very important for me that my children born after 1971 have some sort of say in, they'll get their stock from their dads and from me, but it's really hard to explain to them why their sister gets money and my two younger sons don't get any money or not a part of Chugach Natives. Or I was going to have Joey come and testify, and I drilled it into his head, but I knew what he would come and do, so I decided to testify for him. But that's important that, I don't know how they could do it in Canada or anywhere else, but in some way have a provision that children born after can have some stock. That's it.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yes.
Justice Berger. I really think that is one of the real deep concerns that those of us who have children either born after 1971 or those of us who have lived in the Native community and are a part of the Native community and yet our children are not one quarter, that they be recognized. Because it seems a terrible thing for our young people to lose, along with their cultural heritage, everything else that goes with it. And I, for one, would like to go on record as being supportive in every way of the younger people who were born after 1971. And I would like to see at least the stock that's handed down within the families within the Native families be voting stock as long as it is kept within that family. And I feel that no matter what the degree of Native blood, it should be votable stock. That's all I have to say, I promise.
It up, Jim?
Really?
Well, okay. Get out here and practice in the back 40. Something else that's that hasn't been addressed yet, and this is for future settlements in other countries, other places, is to make sure that you have leadership who is knowledgeable on making these decisions. A few of our corporations have lost millions of dollars in transactions. They were maybe sold a bill of goods or something went wrong, but you read in these annual reports, not too many of the corporations have excess money. They talk about millions that fell along the wayside, and they really can't tell you where it went, but it just disappeared. So in the future then, you need to find people or start educating them now in money management, to in law, like, lawyers. Hear that?
Is that a hint?
Anyway, I thought I should say something along that line. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Ma'am, would you?
My name is Daisy Blatchford. I've lived here since 1954. Everything that was said tonight, most of it I agreed with. Mostly what Edgar said, not because he's my nephew, but I'm lucky if I see him half an hour every year. I'm more concerned about our old people. I wish they would have done something for them. A lot of them passed on. They never even had their hands on anything as far as Native land claims went. Also, I think the Native land claims was just a rush. It was just a rush that people didn't understand. Like everybody said, they just went and signed up, thought they were going to get money and land, and that's all. As far as understanding the details of it, I don't think a lot of them did. I think after the native land claims, maybe because I worked in the public places, I've noticed a lot of races. A lot of things said that kind of hurt me. Each time I bought a new car, oh, she bought it through the native land claims. I've worked ever since I was a teenager. I've never depended on any kind of government stuff. Each time I got my native land claims money, it went to my son's education. I also heard that they want to get rid of the Ayanis Hospital just because the native people got a whole bunch of money. They can start their own hospitals and all the things that went along with it. And I just wish it would have been just publicized better so people in the public would understand what the native land claims was. And when they see a little green envelope in the post office, oh, they all got $1,000, they all got this and they all got that. I've never yet to see that much money, and I'm sure we're not going to see any. And as far as 1991 come, I'm just like everybody else. I'm really concerned. I think a lot of them is going to say 20 years has gone by and I have not benefit from the native land claims, and by God, I'm going to do it when I have the chance. And when they see that dollar sign, they're going to jump to it. And I think we're all going to probably go our ways, and we'll probably never see Native and not like we are today. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Blatchford. Anybody in the back row there?
I'd like to ask Edgar or anybody who knows why they divided it up like they did the regions. Why some are so big, and I know it's a lot to do with their tribe and stuff like that, but
maybe we could ask David Case to answer that. He's the author of the textbook. Textbook on Native rights in Alaska. Do you want to say something about that, David?
We brought you down here at great expense.
And, you think this will defray the expense? The regions were, the boundaries were determined along ethnic lines. And that was to be by agreement, really, among the various regions. And there was also a provision for arbitration between regions in case of disagreement. Was Chugach a region where there was an arbitration? I don't recall for sure. But there was an arbitration between Sea Alaska, I know, and a neighboring region. I thought it was perhaps Chugach. Wasn't? Mm-hmm. But it was on long ethnic lines. That was the idea, ethnic linguistic lines.
Then what happened? They should have done that to Sioux or at large people.
I wasn't there when it happened. I think I'm glad. The regional boundaries were determined along ethnic lines. Now, you say Seward, I guess Seward, the point is that Seward is a many people here, not just the ethnic group that would identify with Chugach. And I guess the only thing you can say is that you could say the same thing about Anchorage. There's a lot of natives living there, and yet that is in within Cook Inlet region. And so they didn't carve out every little pocket of that had different groups of people. They took generally the area that was inhabited historically by that particular ethnic or linguistic group, and divided those into regions. And the pattern for this, I think, was the they were called regional associations at the time, but they became the nonprofit associations. And these associations had become active in these particular regions and had organized each of these regions. And so there was a history of organization as what are now nonprofit corporations. Then they were something else. For the Claims Act settlement, and so they had begun to identify themselves, as I understand it, as groups or within particular regions, and that formed the basis for the 12 regions.
In each region, I think before the Claims Act, Native associations had sprung up, or some of them had existed for a long time, and to a great extent, I think those Native associations and their leaders then became the leaders of the officers of the corporations that were formed in each region. But I think it's fair to say that Congress did the best it could to divide up the regions, as David Case says, along ethnic lines. Tlingit and Haida, Athabasca, Inupiat, Yupik, and so on, and in Cook Inlet and in Chugach, it was a little more difficult to do, I suppose, because of the melting pot character of those places. Sure. I just wanted to make sure anyone who wanted to speak had an opportunity to do so. But if there are any questions, we'll do our best to answer them. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Mabel Osenga. I'm with Chugach Native here in Seward. I would just like to make a comment that on this meeting tonight, how much I have learned about what's in the future and what has happened. I feel here in Seward, there's so many of us from different parts of Alaska up north and even Anchorage or maybe Southeastern who have signed up here in Chugach Native. And it just seemed like we're not just one Aleut, Athabascan or something else. We're just different nationalities of Natives. And I just want to say thank you to all of you and for this real educational meeting we have here. And I'm sorry about not making a comment about my problem with the land, but I didn't have the dates or anything, you know, specific. So thank you very much.
Did you have a question, Mrs. Blatchford?
Yes, I do. I'd like to know why they didn't inform us that we could choose wherever we want to be, and not just because one family chose to be in Cook Inlet, they all have to go to Cook Inlet. They just made it sound like that we had to follow our husbands or whoever's the head of the family. They didn't let us know that we can choose wherever we want to go. And in that sense, that's why I say it was a rush thing. We weren't really quite informed in it before we all got started. Thank you.
Did you want to comment on that, David?
Well, if I can comment, I don't think
it's hard to always explain how a law gets implemented, and I suspect you're right. There was a deadline, for one thing, to enroll people, and so there was a terrible rush initially to get everybody enrolled. And I think you are right that you could enroll actually wherever you wanted, but it was probably bureaucratically easier to enroll people in groups rather than inquire carefully as to where everybody wanted to enroll.
Now, the reason why I said it, and I'm sorry I didn't enroll in mine, because I could have, as a village, all of our family could have got together as a village and we could have benefited more.
Or as a group, you mean, perhaps? Village or group? Village. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's not, I mean, the testimony that you're giving and has been given elsewhere is that that there was not much information, much accurate information about the Claims Act, what it meant either before or after it was passed. And that, I think, is probably a fact, a significant one.
Have a gathering. I think that's the reason why we just see the same faces over and over again, because it's just a few people there that understand. The others don't understand, and they just don't give it. You know what?
The what Mrs. Blatchford is referring to is that where you had fewer than 25 people living in a particular place, they couldn't incorporate as a village, let alone a region, under the Act. So there was provision for groups of less than 25 people to be recognized as groups under the Act and to get some land. Now, if you heard Mr. Anderson talk about spending 20 years to get his allotment, when I've gone around the state, I've heard from some of these groups, and they are tearing their hair out trying to go through all the legal hoops and hurdles to achieve recognition. And that's a very, very difficult thing they're trying to do. Anyway, it's an interesting point. There are just a very, very few people who tried to get recognized as groups, and they're usually closely knit families living off by themselves somewhere, that kind of thing. But they've had real trouble getting recognized.
People that just said they just waited long enough and they're just not benefiting anything, so they just, anybody with standing on the street there, and I'm sure there'll be plenty, they're just going to get rid of it. And if we don't try to organize ourselves some way, see if we can see whether the native corporations in each region could just buy it off of them, you know, but there'll always be somebody that'll be with higher prices, and of course they'll choose that.
Well, that's a good point. Yes, Mrs. Ronnie.
I can tell you a little bit about our experience trying to get a group application. I belong to the Grouse Creek group, and I guess it's 14 years now. And last year, BIA finally came down for about, I think it was about the third or fourth team of people that came down to certify or not certify. And so they decided that they couldn't certify us because we weren't a majority of the area. But we feel we had
our boundaries that we went by from the very beginning, they didn't ask us what we considered the boundaries of our group application, and they went outside our boundaries and picked up a white family, which just made we were the minority then, so they didn't certify us. So we appealed, and that hearing's coming up on the 17th. But in the meantime, if we don't get the land, I understand the state will. So they're so interested, of course, and they've had several teams of people in town, and I feel a little bit discouraged already because the state, with all its resources and all its manpower, against our small group corporation with no funds, I don't know, we're making a try for it.
Thank you for telling us about that. No. Any other questions or comments?
Does Canada have a blood quantum that's usable in all different agencies? Like here we have BIA establishes a quarter, ANS establishes, I think it's the 16th, and Title IV, which services the children in school, goes down to, I think,
as long as the student has some relative that's enrolled to a corporation or has some tribal affiliation, then that student is able to participate in the Title IV Indian Ed program.
So we have all these different blood quantum things, and I think that's a lot of our problem with our land claims, and I wanted to know if Canada had...
Well, Canada doesn't have a blood quantum a test for registration as Native people under what we call the Indian Act, and it applies to Eskimos as well as Indians, but that's... So there aren't any arguments about one quarter, one eighth, and so on and so forth. I should tell you, however, that for many, many years we had another provision that is just now being changed, that was one that you would find quite startling, I suppose, and that is that if an Indian Eskimo woman married a white man, she ceased to be a Native person and ceased to have any rights as a Native person, and any children she had by that white man would have no rights as Native persons. And that was has come to be regarded in recent years as wrong, and Constitution has been changed just this year to ensure that Indian and Eskimo women who marry white men will continue to have all the rights and to be recognized as Indians and Eskimos in Canada, and their children also will have the rights of Indians and Eskimos. The other side of that was that if an Indian man or an Eskimo man married a white woman, he didn't lose anything. He continued to have all the rights of an Indian or an Eskimo under the law, and his children by that white woman would continue to have all those rights. Now, in the old days, that was done for a number of reasons, and but it's been changed now. But it has left us with a real problem. What about all the native people who lost their rights, who should now be given the opportunity to return and to claim their rights? And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And in Canada, the government is just now beginning to address that question. What they have said, though, is that it will be up to each Indian or Eskimo, we call them band councils, you would call them tribal councils, I suppose, to decide who will be recognized. That is, it's up to the local native community to decide who will be recognized as a member of that community, and it's up to them, and it isn't a question of deciding how much blood you've got of this or that. This business of blood quantum can be divisive. In Hawaii, there are laws that say that people who can prove they have 50% Native Hawaiian blood have certain benefits under Hawaiian law, and others who are of Native Hawaiian descent but who cannot prove that they are 50% do not have rights. So they have the same distinctions there as you have here, only yours cut off is at one quarter. In Canada, I think they've decided, and that the best way to handle this is to let the native people decide it themselves. In the lower 48, the Supreme Court of the United States has decided that the question of membership on Indian reservations, who's entitled to be a member of the reservation, is a matter for the tribal council to determine. So what strikes me coming here from Canada is that you have not just the division related to blood quantum, but you have a division according to age. That is, people born before 1971 have the right to be enrolled as full shareholders. After 1971, they may inherit, but if they're not one-quarter native, they don't have the right to vote. And of course, they may get shares in unequal numbers. If you have one child and give him your 100 shares, he'll have 100 shares. If your neighbor has 10 children, the 100 shares has to be divided up 10 ways, and each of those children only has 10 shares. So in the next generation, instead of everybody being able to vote equally, some have 100, some have 10, some have this, some have that. And so when you come here from Canada, you realize that in Alaska, after we spent 100 years trying to get rid of these distinctions in Alaska, you come here and you find that all these distinctions are being reinvented. It seems to be endemic. It seems to happen in every country. But as I say, in the Supreme Court of the U.S. They decided, and in Canada, Parliament has decided that really it should be up to the native people themselves to determine who will be allowed, who will be recognized as a member. Have I got that right?
Well, yeah. Certainly in Canada you do.
It's, I think, long been the case in the United States that the question of tribal membership has been up to the tribal council. Now, of course, the situation in Alaska is that the corporations are determine stock ownership, and and tribal councils in Alaska can still determine membership in a native community. but that doesn't determine.
As any tribal council in the United States can.
Yes, yeah. But that doesn't determine the ownership of the shares. And I think maybe if this is sort of going in and out of fog now, it's important to keep two points in mind, that corporations are businesses. They are business organizations. And tribal councils are governments. And that is a different kind of an institution than a business corporation. And governments determine who their members will be all the time. That's called citizenship. And there are still, in Alaska, governments of natives in native communities, as well as in native villages, village corporations, businesses. And so there are those two institutions. And you are a shareholder in a corporation, but you can be a member of a tribe or a village community. Now, where does that leave Seward? And I suppose that's an interesting question.
Barely got on the map.
Well, but you're on the map then.
Yeah, but we're so confused.
Mrs. Swartz?
I find that a sort of a puzzle too, because we were east of the mountains and there was quite a large Indian reservation near Newport. We knew a large family, and children were 1/16. And here's where you're talking of tribal government, right? All right, when timber or anything was sold, every member enrolled to the reservation got their share or whatever it was. And I remember thinking at that time that it was really quite strange, because that isn't the way it is up here. And I know that you can cut a piece of pie only so many times, and then you won't have any.
That's when you talk about the division of the proceeds from a tribal transaction, like I think you mean by then, yeah, lumber. So some timber is sold, and then the money can be divided up among all of the tribal members. That's not like dividing up the land among all the tribal members, or dividing up some kind of evidence, stock, ownership in the land among all the tribal members. You can only do that so many times before you end up with, you know, just the pieces of the pie.
I think it's things like this that we know that are confusing to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that may be, I'm not advocating any particular point here, but it may be that is one of the reasons that native governments are becoming of interest in Alaska, because as institutions they don't seem to have some of these problems. But I think it's very important in looking at it all to realize that there are two institutions, two different kinds of institutions, businesses, corporations, and political institutions called governments. And they work different ways. They have their strengths and their weaknesses, both of them.
Well, we cleared that up.
It's good to get an answer.
Yeah.
Justice Berger, can you tell us briefly what you'll be be taking back to Canada to, in whatever capacity you do have, what are some of the main points that you've learned throughout your travels in Alaska that you'll be bringing back to Canada?
Right,
yeah. In 50 words or less, please.
Well, my job is to really to do two things. The first and most important job is to conduct these hearings and then write a report in which I will try to make recommendations to assist you, Alaska Natives, whether you're village people, at large shareholders, or urban shareholders, another category, or whatever. I also will be giving advice to Native people in other countries, but you should bear in mind that those Native people in other countries have already, some of them, been to Alaska and looked at your settlement, because they are engaged in negotiations with their own governments now. Canada, there have been a number of land claim settlements by Eskimo and Indian people in the last 13 years, that is, since ANCSA was brought in. And most of those Eskimo and Indian people from Canada came here and went around and met regional corporation leaders and village corporation people and tribal government leaders and so on. And decided, for the most part, not to adopt your kind of corporation. That is, they have corporations, but they are corporations which are perpetual. Every Native person born into the village or the tribe becomes a member of the corporation, and when that person dies, ceases to be a member. But there are no shares that anyone could ever sell or transfer. Or so that's one thing they have decided against. In Maine, the Indian people there settled with the government of the United States just 2 years ago in 1982. And they looked at the Alaskan settlement and they didn't adopt it. They've got something that in turn is different. And one of the things I've been saying is, it's not really apparent here this evening, but in many villages we get people arguing about corporations versus tribal governments, which is the best. And David Case has pointed out some of the advantages on each side. And I've said to those people, well, let's make sure we don't just get locked into this argument about corporations and tribal governments. Let's look at what they're doing in other countries and see what if there are any new ideas out there that we can use. In Australia, for instance, they have they're now settling their land claims, and they have trusts that in which the land is held by the elders for all the people. In Canada, the Eskimos in the Mackenzie Delta, which is in the Arctic, just settled, and their settlement came into force last month, August 1984. And they have a trust which is held by all of the Inuit, and the federal government doesn't act as trustee. The Inuit hold the trust themselves. The Inuit, I mean the Eskimos. They call themselves Inuit in Canada. And the federal government also agreed that they would never tax their land. And that agreement becomes entrenched in the Constitution so that they can't ever go back on their word and try to impose a tax. So everybody is trying new ideas. And some of the things that you did in Alaska are admired in other countries. Some of the things you did, I don't by you, I mean what Congress did, are people have decided they don't want to do that. And so maybe in these discussions we're having here in Alaska now, we can learn from what some of these other people are doing. Yes, sir.
I'd like to say a word as an observer tonight.
Yeah, please do.
I'm only a native from North Dakota. I'm Glenn Groth. I'd like to make three observations. One is I don't think you'll educate your people to the point that they will protect what is theirs. I don't think that's possible. I think it's futile if you expect that. Because I don't think anybody is going to value that enough, except in a moment of weakness or whatever, money is going to be more valuable than what is handed down to them. I think that's a fact of life. I don't think that you will educate the non-native people to treat you with respect because of ignorance and racist attitudes that are in our society. I don't think you can expect that. I think you have a dignity within yourself and you hold that, and irrespective of how people treat you. A third thing, I don't think that you will protect this heritage by any other means than making it illegal to pass it outside of the native group. I don't think there is any other way that you'll protect that. It'd have to be punishable by, you know, some severe way, I think, if you're going to protect it. That's just my opinion as I listen to these things. And the last thing is sort of a question. As an observer and as one who has watched this in Alaska since I first came here in 1956, you've come a long way, baby. What is there that we who are not native can do to help? And I think you have lots of friends in Alaska who are in their hearts are asking this question and would join with you in lobbying efforts or whatever to stand alongside of you or behind you or whatever to assist. And I suppose really in a sense to say, what is it you want to do? And secondly, how can we help? And I can only say that for one, but I am one. I am, yeah, yeah.
Well, any other comments or questions this evening? Yes.
Do you attend some of these AFN meetings and all the different top Native organizations meeting?
Well, I met with the AFN board of directors last year. Last September, I believe it was, and spent a day with them. They had asked me to come. They wanted to know what this commission was about, and I explained what I had been asked to do and what I intended to do. And I spoke to the Convention of the United Tribes of Alaska last year, and I'm speaking to the Convention of the Alaska Native Brotherhood this year, this fall. And many of the AFN officials who are officers of regional corporations have come to meetings like this and testified.
Do they have any plans for 1991? Anything in mind? Or?
Oh, I think that they are thinking very hard about 1991 and holding discussions about it. Of that, I have no doubt. I'm sure they are.
Have they since 1971, or is it just a thing in the past, like 4 years ago?
Well, I don't really know, but I know that that they've been for as long as I've been here, since September 1983, obviously very much concerned about 1991. Just about every Native corporation and Native organization seems to be concerned about 1991.
When they have a stockholders meeting, a lot of the people just can't attend because of the cost and all. The issue of the small checks that they get, but it does not cover their hotel and room and board, transportation. So a lot of them don't go. They don't get any kind of input. A lot of us are working the time that they have it, and then we can't go. So we just don't get, you know, as much input as we want to get out of it.
Yeah, well, it's an imperfect world, but certainly now people here are talking about 1991, and everywhere we've been, they're talking about 1991, and they understand it. People in every village and town we've been to understand that if a majority in a corporation sell their shares, they lose their corporation and their land. They understand that if the state imposes a property tax on Native lands and the Native corporations can't pay the tax, can lose your land that way. So it's not as if people don't know what 1991 is all about. They do, and they're concerned about, well, what are we going to do?
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Mrs. Ronnie.
In Canada, they won't tax the Native lands forever?
Well, in the in Canada, we have what you have in the Lower 48 and what they have at Metlakatla, the reservations. And those can't be taxed because they have their own governments, and those Native governments do the taxing. But the federal and state governments don't tax them. In the latest settlements reached in the Canadian Arctic, the Eskimos and the Indians have said, well, we don't want reservations because we don't want our land to be held in trust by the federal government for us. We're grown up, we want to hold the land ourselves. So the federal government has agreed, and the legislation says, okay, this land is held by the Eskimos, and they hold it in trust for themselves. And the federal government has agreed that they will not impose a property tax unless the land is developed. That is, if they decide they want to bring the oil companies in and drill for oil, and if they find oil, well, then they have to share the wealth with the federal government. But as long as they're using it for subsistence, for hunting and fishing and trapping, they will not be obliged ever to pay any taxes, property taxes. So that's just, I only mention that because it only happened this summer. And in the Yukon Territory, the Indians there, their leaders reached an agreement with the federal government about settling their land claims. And they came to Anchorage and testified and explained it all to us just a few months ago. But they said that there were 12 villages, and 10 of the villages had to agree by majority vote to ratify the settlement before it would come into force. Well, only 8 have agreed, and 4 won't. So they're going to have to go back to the federal government and say, this isn't good enough, we have to renegotiate. And their settlement, it contained an agreement that their land wouldn't ever be subject to tax. They were given land in fee simple. They were given subsistence, a subsistence preference throughout territory. But in the end, they said, we want our own, the dissenting villages said, we want our own native government. It illustrates how all the things that you're talking about here in Alaska are going on just across the boundary there. It's in, and many other places. Well, any other observations or comments or questions tonight? Well, if not, I think I should thank you all for coming and for the contributions that you've made. I think it's been a good discussion, and it's certainly been helpful to me. I think this is the first place we've been to where the shareholders living here are at large shareholders, so it was useful to us to find out how the land claim settlement had affected you here. If you decide that you want to say something further, please just send a letter to me at our address in Anchorage, set your views down on paper, and I'll be happy to read it over. Our address is 429 D Street, that's in Anchorage. Right. Well, I'm sure you've got it. So if you do decide you want to say something further, please don't hesitate to send a letter to me. So let me thank you all for coming and to say how much I appreciated the contributions that you all made. And we'll adjourn the meeting and move on to Tatitlek tomorrow. Tatitlek. Okay, so thanks again.
Thank you.
Here's that list of names. If you want to grab any before oh, he's got it over there. Sorry.
Thank you again. Very nice to
meet you. Thank you, Carol. Really invited you to come. Nice evening. Actually, very pleasant sort of atmosphere.
Yeah, we all get along real well, and I know from seeing some of the hearings and attending camp and that there are a lot of people that are upset and really polarizing.
Court comes out straight.
Very soft-spoken. Polite, I hope.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Hope you have a good trip and enjoy the
visit to the region.
Or are we going?
Well, I didn't know what going on.
Do you put those word by word or you give them all?
I mean,